Morning. We'll call the Senate Finance Committee to order. We're in Juneau, Alaska. Please silence your cell phones. Today is January the 24th. I'm joined by Co-Chairman Stidman. Co-Chairman Olson is excused from the call today. Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, and Senator Cronk. And I think Senator Giesel and Senator Yunt are in the audience joining us today. So with that, we have before us on today's agenda, we have the revenue forecast from the Department of Revenue. Please come forward, Commissioner Adam Crum, and any assistants that you want, please introduce them, and welcome back to the Senate Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Adam Crum, Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. It's good to see you guys again. Today, we're going to be going over the fall 2024 forecast. It's going to be led by Chief Economist Dan Stickle. I also have at the table our hired tax director about 5 months in the job, Dale Yancey. And so he'll also have some remarks throughout as well. But we're glad to be here and go over these numbers with you.
Great. Please proceed. Daniel?
All right. For the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with Department of Revenue, and thank you for the opportunity to come here today and present our fall 2024 revenue forecast. Slide two is some just the agenda for the presentation. So we'll start with some background on the revenue forecast and key assumptions. We'll walk through the numbers, both in terms of total state revenue and then drilling down into the unrestricted general fund portion of the revenue. And then the third section of the presentation is detailed assumptions around the oil revenue forecast in particular. So slide four is some background on the revenue forecast. The fall forecast was released on December 12th, concurrent with the governor's budget release. Our revenue forecast and past revenue forecasts are available on the Tax Division's website at tax.alaska.gov. In the fall, we publish a large 100-plus page publication called the Revenue Sources Book that has detailed revenue about all the state's revenue sources, a variety of data looking back for the last 10 years, as well as a 10-year forecast for the different revenue sources. Just a lot of great information and a lot of work goes into that publication. To produce the revenue sources book, there's a lot of work on from our team within Department of Revenue. We utilize data from the state accounting system, from the tax accounting system. We also coordinate with numerous other state agencies, Department of Natural Resources on the production forecast, in particular Permanent Fund Corporation, a lot of other contributions that go into that. The publication does fulfill two statutory requirements. So there's a statutory requirement that the governor provide a revenue forecast for the current and next fiscal year. And then there's another statutory requirement that we support that the governor provides a 10-year fiscal plan. Slide five are some of the key assumptions in this revenue forecast. So we do want to point out the forecast is it's a discrete forecast that provides one set of numbers that's within a range of potential outcomes, and want to highlight that the different variables do have a range of uncertainty around them. So for the fall forecast, for the investment revenue forecast, we include actual revenues and returns through the end of October. We include an assumption of 7.9% return for the permanent fund for the remainder of fiscal 2025. And then the long-term assumption for fiscal 26 and beyond is 7.65% annual return. Federal revenues incorporate known stimulus funding and the best information around federal funds as of December 1st of 2024. And then for petroleum revenues, we are basing our forecast on a $73.86 per barrel oil price for fiscal year 2025. That includes 5 months of actual prices and then a forecast for the remainder of the year. Our forecast for fiscal 26 is $70 per barrel, and we use the futures market to project out beyond that with oil prices remaining around that $70 range at $72 by fiscal year 2034. On the non-petroleum revenue side of things, which is a smaller contribution to revenue, but important to the specific industries, we're assuming continued robust activity with 1.6 million cruise ship passengers each year. On the fishing industry, the last 2 years have been extremely challenging in that industry. For revenue forecasting purposes, we're assuming a 5-year recovery in terms of fisheries tax revenues, which may not align with a recovery in the total economic impact from those industries, but that's what we're assuming for tax revenues. And then for mining, we use futures market to predict out our prices for the minerals. We're assuming continued operations of the major mines and mills in the state. We are not assuming any significant new mines coming online. Slide 6 is a graphical depiction of total state revenue. This is revenue from all different funds. In fiscal year 2024, total state revenue totaled $16.3 billion, and the largest contributions to that total revenue were federal receipts, investment earnings, and petroleum revenue, with all other revenue sources amounting to about 7.4% of total state revenue. And just to point out, just because those other industries outside of the federal investment and petroleum make a small contribution to revenue, they do make significant contributions to employment and the overall economy of the state. And then slide 7 is a very similar slide, just for our fiscal year 2025 forecast. We're forecasting $16.8 billion. Of total state revenue, again with federal investment and petroleum contributing the majority of revenue, amounting to about 92% of the total state revenue share. So now diving into the numbers, starting with slide 9, this shows some of the key changes to the unrestricted revenue forecast. Compared to the spring forecast that was released in early 2024. For oil prices, we decreased our forecast by $4.14 per barrel for fiscal year 25 to $73.86, and we decreased our fiscal year 26 forecast by $4 per barrel down to $70 per barrel. And those new forecasts just reflect updated information from the futures market, as well as for the fiscal year 2025 forecast, some additional actual data. For the oil production forecast, as you heard yesterday from the Department of Natural Resources, the forecast for fiscal year 2025 was decreased by about 10,000 barrels a day to 467,000 barrels per day. And for fiscal year 2026, a reduction of about 12,600 barrels per day to 469,500 barrels per day. On this one section of slide 9, just to point out, we did have an earlier version of the presentation that had a typo and did not have the brackets around that 12.6 number, but that is a reduction to the forecast. For the permanent fund transfer, due to the way that the transfer is calculated, the fiscal year 2026 number is now known. It's based on the average market value for the first 5 of the last 6 fiscal years. Performance at the end of fiscal year 2024 exceeded expectations, and so we did increase that fiscal year 2026 transfer estimate by about $9 million. In terms of total unrestricted general fund revenue, the reduction was about $220 million for the fiscal 25 forecast and about $232 million for the fiscal year 2026 forecast. And the reduction to the oil price outlook was the primary driver in terms of the unrestricted revenue changes.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if you could help a little bit on both the price and the volume, but on price, I think since the department took a look at that and projected the price, there's been some changes in Washington and maybe some directional adjustments. And I was wondering if the department had any initial gut feeling for what maybe a little different coming at us compared to a month or so ago when the numbers were put together.
Mr. Stickle.
Sure. Co-Chair Stedman, in terms of oil prices, prices have been trending slightly above our forecast since we released the forecast in the fall. So that is one bit of good news. I do have a slide coming up later in the presentation that looks at current prices and current outlook. More broadly, in terms of the new administration, yes, there's a lot of optimism out there around potential opportunities. Those have not yet been factored into this forecast.
Okay. And then if I could, Mr. Chairman, on volume, we're having a warmer than expected winter, I think, which doesn't help production. Slows things down. Is there and then there's the decrease projected here, of the 12,000 barrels a day. Could you help me why there was a surprise on the downward side, and is the current weather, warm winter, going to potentially affect this forecast for the spring? And this is just your feeling, right? I understand that you make the official forecast, but there's the official forecast, and then what you think's coming at us.
Sure. Co-Chair Stedman, unfortunately, I don't have the production tracking in front of me. I believe we're largely on track with the fall forecast in terms of where production has been coming in.
And the warmer weather, do you think it'll materially affect the production, or something we shouldn't worry about?
Yeah, so Co-Chair Stedman, so generally warmer weather tends to put a damper on production just due to the way the reservoir dynamics work in gas handling. They're able to produce more oil in colder weather, so that is something to keep an eye on.
Senator Stedman.
And just for those watching home, the reason I'm asking these questions is some of us are at the table are concerned with the revenue projections meeting some of the expenditure wishes of some of our colleagues in the building. They're not matching up very close. In other words, we've got to have a balanced budget, Mr. Chairman, and we might have a tough time.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Commissioner Crum. As we step back and we pull up the kind of current actual production values that we've seen on a daily basis, I'd be happy to actually share that with the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Stickle.
All right. Again, Dan Stickle for the record. Moving on to slide 10. So slide 10 shows our total state revenue from all sources for fiscal year 2024, as well as our forecast for fiscal year 25 and fiscal year 26. So when we're looking at total state revenue, that's broken out into four categories, consistent with how the categories are used for budgetary purposes. So the unrestricted general funds, those are revenues that can be appropriated by the legislature for any purpose. And those are typically the primary focus of budget discussions. The next category of revenue is designated general fund revenues. These are technically available for appropriation, but customarily are used for specific purposes. So there's a slightly lesser level of discretion around those. And an example of a designated general fund revenue is the state's vehicle rental tax, where that is deposited into a special subaccount of the general fund and appropriated to fund tourism development and marketing. The third category is other restricted revenue. These are funds that are truly restricted in how they can be used, and there's little discretion around appropriating those. An example is the commercial passenger vessel tax, where federal law dictates that we have to use any of those funds in direct support of the cruise ship industry and passengers. And then finally, we show federal revenue, and the federal government places different provisions around how we have to use different federal receipts, and so we show the entirety of federal revenue as restricted revenue. In total, the state received $16.3 billion of total state revenue in fiscal year 2024, and we're forecasting $16.8 billion for fiscal 25 and $15.7 billion for fiscal year 2026. And then slide 11 just pulls out the unrestricted general fund portion of the previous slide, and this will be the focus for the remainder of the presentation, since this is where there is the most flexibility and discretion in the budgetary process. So the largest source of unrestricted revenue is investment revenue, contributed $3.7 billion in fiscal year 2024, and forecast at $3.8 billion for fiscal 25 and $3.9 billion for fiscal 26. The largest portion of that is the percent of market value transfer from the permanent fund to the general fund that began in 2019. Petroleum revenue generated about $2.5 billion of unrestricted revenue in fiscal 24 and is forecast at $1.8 billion in fiscal 25 and $1.7 billion in fiscal 26. And then lastly, non-petroleum revenues are forecast to contribute a little under $600 million per year in fiscal years 25 and 26. So the next couple of slides will walk through each of these three categories, beginning with the unrestricted investment revenue. The permanent fund transfer alone is expected to contribute between 59 and 64% of unrestricted revenue over the next 10 years. And in addition to that permanent fund transfer, there's a small amount of other unrestricted revenue representing primarily earnings on the cash balances of the general fund. Those amounted to a little under $150 million in fiscal 24. We are expecting a decline to about $88 million in fiscal 26, and that's based on an expectation of lower interest rates on cash. Slide 13 looks at that estimated transfer from the permanent fund to the general fund. So this transfer is estimated to be over $3.5 billion each year over the 10-year forecast, steadily increasing to nearly $5 billion by 2035. The forecast is based on an assumption of a 7.65% long-term annual return for the permanent fund and a 5% of market value calculation. And that 5% calculation is based on the average ending market value for the first five of the last six fiscal years, which makes it a fairly stable revenue source, given the fact that when we're looking at the budget for the current year, we know with certainty what the permanent fund transfer will be. Important to note, this transfer includes money for both government services and the dividend. Statute does not dictate how that split is made.
So prior to the passage of Senate Bill 26 in 2019, for the audience, where was the major source of revenue to operate state government?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So prior to 2019, the oil and gas revenue was the primary source. We had several years where we were running budget deficits, led to this change to incorporate a portion of investment revenue towards funding government services.
So that was a major changing point for the state of Alaska.
Absolutely.
To get steady revenue. Prior to that, no revenue was ever spent out of the permanent fund earnings reserve account. In fact, that was considered taboo to the legislature to even consider spending those dollars. Please proceed.
Senator Stegman.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make kind of half a comment and a point, I guess, on slide 13. As a revenue commissioner, you're on the permanent fund board, correct, as a representative for the governor? So the concern some of us have is a mismatch between the asset allocation of the permanent fund being too heavily in illiquid investments relative to the customer, which is us, the state. And I recognize that there's, you know, a requirement for the permanent fund to maximize a risk-return relationship and maximize their growth. But we also have a 5% payout of the permanent fund that we have to meet. And some of us are getting concerned that there's substantially too much weight in illiquid investments, which restricts the ability of the permanent fund to generate cash from dividends and trading profits to facilitate the earnings reserve, which is what we have to rely on to draw the 5% from. And I just want to point that out. You know, when we have that conversation with the permanent fund coming, that'll be in the middle of the table as we struggle to move forward in time to hopefully move the earnings reserve into the corpus, get rid of the earnings reserve, and totally eliminate this particular friction that we have today. But that may come in 2 years. It may come in 4 years. We've been working on it for 20. Mm-hmm. We don't know when that is going to come, but eventually it'll come. But we want to make sure we can meet our obligations along the way. I just thought I'd, while you're sitting here, I just thought I'd mention that as a representative to that board.
Mr. Commissioner?
Through the chair to Co-Chair Stedman. For the record, this is Commissioner Crum. As you mentioned, I also sit as a trustee on the Permanent Fund Corporation. And, yes, what you have just mentioned, the liquidity risk of the 5% draw is a constant point of discussion amongst the trustees and amongst the staff. This long-term, this total return of 7.9% in FY 2024 is barely making the intergenerational equity goals of the original intent of the permanent fund, because we use a long-term assumption of 2.5% for inflation along with the 5% draw, which means it's really your internal, your real rate of return is 7.5. And so that is the hard part that we have to break to make sure we're there. And at the 7.9 and then the future expectation of 7.65, it is this delicate dance, because part of this is in statute we have to maximize risk-adjusted returns. And so we are getting outstanding returns in alpha generation for the level of risk we are taking. But that is something we have to weigh in to make sure that there is cash available, because it is the realized gains versus the unrealized gains issue, particularly with an asset allocation like we have. As we look at where we sit amongst our peers, we are somewhere between a public pension fund and an endowment, like at a university, from a risk standpoint. But this two-account system, the earnings reserve and the corpus, does limit how much is spun out and what is the spendable portion for the draw. So Trustee Paper 10 last year did kind of illustrate that, about the benefits of combining the two accounts via constitutional amendment and allowing the legislature up to a 5% draw of the POMV. It alleviates some of that concern. We were in very dire straits last fall. The most recent updated analysis we have from our investment consultant, Callen, in the December board meeting did show that the risk of not having available earnings in FY27 and beyond for the POMV has decreased a little bit, but the risk still is outstanding, and it's something that's going to be on an ongoing basis. And I imagine it's going to be a large point of discussion at our upcoming mid-February quarterly board meeting. And this is something that is something we'd like all Alaskans to try and pay attention to. Executive Director Mitchell has been doing this in a lot of his public outreach to try and educate people as to why this proposal of the two accounts becoming one from a liquidity standpoint just has to do with the overall basis of how the fund is built.
For the audience, listening audience, the requirement to join those two funds requires a constitutional amendment. And the reason that it is so difficult, it takes 14 votes in the Senate and 27 votes in the House to accomplish this, and then that would bring it forward for a vote of the people. But because of the high standards for constitutional amendments, this has been the stumbling block. Senator Stedman?
I just appreciate those comments, Mr. Chairman. And we'll have this conversation going forward. Is 5% the appropriate rate? Right? Maybe it is. Maybe it's not. And there's some discussion to be had there. But nevertheless, we still have to have liquidity, and we're very concerned not only with the permanent fund but our retirement accounts that we don't push the rate of return requirements so high we increase our risk exposure. Right, by too heavy of a draw or what have you, chasing returns. We don't want to do that. So anyway, there's just wanted to take the time just to let you know that some of us are concerned that the percent of the illiquid assets within the permanent fund is starting to compound some problems.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Mr. Stickle, please proceed.
All right, again, for the record, Dan Stickle with Revenue. So slide 14 shows a breakout of the different sources of unrestricted petroleum revenue. So there's four main sources here. The state's oil and gas production tax is our severance tax on petroleum. For the North Slope, this consists of a net profits tax with a gross minimum tax floor and a variety of credits. At current prices, we are expecting that some but not all companies will be paying above that gross minimum tax floor. The production tax is expected to bring about $563 million in fiscal year 2025 and $441 million in fiscal year 2026. Next up, the state levies a corporate income tax on qualifying oil and gas corporations doing business in the state. This applies to some but not all of the companies producing oil in the state. We are forecasting $210 million for fiscal year 2025 and $250 million for fiscal year 2026. And the final significant tax on oil and gas is the petroleum property tax. This is levied on all oil and gas property in the state. It consists of a 20 mils tax on all property, and any property tax levied by municipalities is allowed as a credit against the state tax. So the state generates a little over $130 million per year from the property tax, with another over $500 million generated for municipalities. And then the largest source of unrestricted petroleum revenue to the state is from royalties and related revenues. Brought in about $1.15 billion in fiscal year 2024 and forecast at $942 million for fiscal year 2025 and $898 million for fiscal year 2026. This represents the state's portion of the oil and gas production as the owner of resources on state land. In addition to the amounts shown here for unrestricted revenue, there's a significant amount deposited into the permanent fund and school fund as well that are considered restricted revenue.
You had mentioned that the property tax for municipalities is $500 million, but that is not spread across the state. That is only available for those incorporated areas of the state along the gas line, that being the North Slope Borough, Fairbanks Borough, and the Valdez Borough. So you have to be along that corridor in order to have access to those taxes. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So the municipalities have the ability to levy a property tax on property within their municipalities. So as you mentioned, North Slope Borough is a major recipient of property tax revenue.
Please proceed.
Slide 15 is a similar breakout looking at non-petroleum revenues, unrestricted non-petroleum revenues. The largest component here is taxes, and then the largest component of that is the non-petroleum corporate income tax, which we are forecasting at $210 million for fiscal year 2025 and $230 million for fiscal year 2026. That's a bit of an increase over prior years. We had several years of lower corporate income tax collections due to COVID-era losses and the ability to carry forward some of those losses. We are expecting that we're starting to work through those and expecting collections from corporate income taxes to increase. In addition, the economy at a national level has been doing quite well. So looking for increased corporate profitability. Other significant taxes include the mining license tax, insurance premium tax, fisheries taxes, and excise taxes. One point that will jump out on slide 15 is the negative $1 million for mining license tax in fiscal year 2024. And that's due to a combination of there were some one-time issues where we paid out some large refunds. And then also weak minerals prices in calendar year 2023 for zinc in particular led to lower payments coming in fiscal year 2024. So in total, non-petroleum taxes forecast to generate a little over $440 million in each of the next 2 years. And then there's a other category at the bottom of this, all other non-petroleum unrestricted revenue. Around a little over $140 million per year, and that consists of a variety of licenses and permits, charges for services, non-petroleum rents and royalties, and miscellaneous revenue like dividends from state-owned corporations.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, I know for this presentation you guys put the pencils down 7-8 weeks ago. We don't have our own corporate income tax code, really. We base our take off what Uncle Sam does. As we look at, I think the term people are using is the newfound alignment in Washington, D.C., what is the Department of Revenue's comfort level that in FY26 we're still going to see increasing corporate income tax collections as all the conversation there seems to be about corporate income tax cuts?
Sure. Senator Keel, through the chair. So our corporate income tax, as you mentioned, we use the federal tax code as kind of a starting point for our corporate income tax. So for non-petroleum revenues, we apportion total federal income to the state, but then the tax rate is set by the legislature. So a cut, interestingly, if the federal government were to cut the corporate income tax rate, if that were to lead to additional economic activity, that would actually could increase the tax base for Alaska's corporate income tax. So I think, based on the latest information, I think we still have a decent amount of confidence around these forecasts for corporate income tax. That said, corporate income tax is one of the more volatile revenue sources, so there's always a range of uncertainty around the predictions.
Just a follow-up, if you may. Thank you. Mr. Stickle, certainly what Uncle Sam charges in terms of the rate doesn't affect our take particularly. And the silly dynamic scoring stuff has proven to be just that. But it's what goes into the taxable line that concerns me. And a great deal of the work Congress tends to do on the tax code really does have an effect on how much income ends up subject to tax at all. So I'll be intrigued to see whether it's just that simple or whether, in fact, we're in for a ride here.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Mr. Yancey, do you have some comments?
Yes, Chair Hoffman. For the record, this is Director Yancey, Department of Revenue. Correctly stated, Senator Keel, that in President Trump's first term, the federal corporate rate was reduced from 35% to 21%, but that in of itself, the rate change doesn't impact the state of Alaska because we're using worldwide income, which is apportioned to Alaska, and so the federal rates doesn't impact what's here. But yeah, and so if in a second Trump term, if they were to reduce the rates further or something like that, it would not affect Alaska. We do rolling conformity, and you correctly pointed out that if they change what's in the base, that could impact us because we conform ourselves to the federal law for the most part.
Thank you, Director Yancey. Mr. Stickle, please proceed.
Sure. Dan Stickle again for the record. I think we are ready to move on to the petroleum forecast assumptions details section of the presentation. So starting with slide 17, this starts with oil prices, and we show our 10-year forecast for Alaska North Slope crude oil prices for the fall forecast compared to the spring forecast. As you can see, based on the latest futures market projections, there has been a slight reduction to the price outlook for all years in the forecast. For fiscal 2025, that was a reduction of $4.14 per barrel and a $4 per barrel reduction for fiscal 26, and then smaller reductions for each of the subsequent years. We generated this price forecast on December 1st. We used the last five trading days of November as our sample from the futures market to generate the revenue forecast. And we use the futures market because it provides a extremely timely and a very transparent methodology for producing our oil price forecast. Slide 18 compares our forecast to various other sources as of earlier this week. We compare to Brent futures prices from the Energy Information Agency, that's the federal government agency, the most recent futures market projections, as well as an average analyst forecast that we look at from Bloomberg. And we compare to Brent prices because that's an international benchmark that's very widely forecast and tends to trade at a valuation quite similar to Alaska crude oil. So I guess a bit of the good news is that oil prices have increased a little bit since we released our forecast in the fall, and it currently looks like for the next year or so that our forecast may be slightly conservative, to the tune of $5 to $10 per barrel, potentially. Out beyond the next year or so, there is generally a consensus of the different sources of data that oil prices will remain in roughly the $70 range, plus or minus $5 or $10 per barrel.
Please proceed.
And then slide 19 puts some dollar values to this concept that oil prices may not be exactly what we forecast. So for fiscal year 2026, we based the forecast on $70 per barrel average Alaska North Slope oil price. That equated to $2.4 billion of unrestricted general fund revenue outside of the permanent fund transfer. And what this slide shows is at different average oil prices, how that revenue number would change. So the heuristic that we use around the oil, around the forecast, is that each dollar change of oil price equates to about $35 million of unrestricted general fund revenue. At higher prices, that delta changes to about $75 million per barrel, and at lower prices, it changes to about $25 million per barrel. And so the slight curve on the chart has to do with the progressive element of our oil and gas production tax system.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we look forward in your previous chart, you know, you had 2027, and we had the Energy Information Agency's estimate of prices somewhere in the mid-60s. If we were to hit that mid-60s in, you know, I guess two fiscal years out, what position would the state be in, and how much would be left in the CBR? And does the department take a look at not the 10-year, because some of us will, it's a waste of time, in my opinion, 3 to 5 years, how do we get to year three without going bust, or year five? Because it doesn't do any good if you go broke in year three worrying about year 10. You're out of business. So how do we get to year three and year five?
Sure.
Commissioner?
Yeah, it was, as far as the work that our group does, we provide a detailed sensitivity analysis to the legislature and the administration so that you can understand exactly what impact different oil prices would have on revenues. We have a version of this in Appendix A1 of the Revenue Sources book that basically includes the same information from slide 19 for also fiscal years 27 and 28. And we have an additional, more detailed version that we provide to anyone that's interested in receiving that.
Senator Stedman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I know there's seven of us here at the committee, but and we all might have different interests. But, Mr. Chairman, I think sometime over the next couple months, I'd like to hopefully get enough interest at the table to take a look at a three-year projection and a five-year projection and talk about how do we get there. Because if oil prices are at 65 or 60, it's going to be a lot more difficult than if they're at 80.
Along with that, the target for the constitutional budget reserve balance has been stated to be around $5 billion as the safe amount in the fund, and that has been stated by several departments. Does the department have a goal of what they feel is a comfortable amount in the constitutional budget reserve balance?
Mr. Chair, for the record, this is Commissioner Crum. When we look at daily cash flow purposes, we have our the amount that we use along with the general fund. We state that as well as in the constitutional budget reserve. We do have a working agreement between Department of Revenue, OMB, and law as to, like, what is the absolute floor, like, what is the dangerous aspect, and that's in the $400 to $500 million range. When you look at the long-term projections, I think one of the things that Senator Stedman was trying to get at is we do these a comprehensive analysis up to the following fiscal year, so like FY26 as we look at that with all of the other revenue sources. You're asking us to compile that to like 2, 3, and 4 years out to actually show what that total number is based upon expenditures. Would that help the committee's trying to look at?
Yes. Senator Stedman.
Yes, and we're not trying to put the department on the spot today with these answers,
yeah.
Just kind of coming attractions, because the concern some of us have is the spending appetite in the building is not highly correlated with the revenue expectations. That's the concern. And I think if we, you know, take a good look at what we can reasonably expect to come at us to 3 to 5 years, that might help damper some of the spending interests and help us you know, get there without a lesser amount of difficulty than if we get to your $500 million number in a CBR, and then the next year we run a deficit, we are in trouble.
And I believe this will become very clear on Monday when we hear from the department, from the Office of Budget and Management on what's being proposed. The one budget that the governor submitted with a full dividend shows us north of $1.5 billion in deficits, and in order to pay for that, that would take up a substantial amount of the constitutional budget reserve balance, which is a place that I'm not interested in going. Senator Steadman, do you have any final comments? Mr. Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that clarification. And I think what we do is when we do project these numbers out, we rarely actually present it aggregated. There are these individual analysis that you can pull from sensitivity, but I think that's something that we could work on. We'll talk internally and have discussions with the committee and OMB on what that is for the next 3 to 5 years in an aggregated format so you can see where those potential revenues that we're forecasting are compiled into.
Thank you very much. Mr. Stickle, please continue.
All right, again, Dan Stickle for the record. So slide 20 is a summary of information that was presented to the committee yesterday. This shows the North Slope oil production forecast for the next 10 years, as well as a high case and a low case. Again, we work collaboratively with Department of Natural Resources. They're the lead on the production forecast. Generally, the story over the next several years is a story of stability. So we're looking at production remaining in that 460 up to 500,000 barrel per day range as natural declines in the mature existing fields are offset by additional drilling in those fields. And then once you get to beyond 2027, 2028 or so, that stability is overlaid by additional production expected from new fields coming online, Pikka and Willow being two of the largest, but several other smaller developments as well. Slide 21 shows how this forecast was changed between the spring forecast and the fall forecast. There were reductions to the annual production outlook for fiscal 25 through 27 in particular. And then for fiscal years 2031 and beyond, there were some increases to the forecast based on increased confidence around those new fields coming online. Slide 22 shows how allowable lease expenditures for the North Slope has changed over the past couple of years, as well as a 10-year forecast. So these are the costs of production that are reported on production tax returns. They are deductible in the net profits portion of the production tax calculation. And we also like to look at lease expenditures as an important barometer of industry investment and spending in the state of Alaska. So in fiscal year 2024, capital expenditures on the North Slope were $4.2 billion. And operating expenditures were an additional $2.9 billion. Fiscal 24 saw significant spending and ramp up in spending on new developments like Pikka and Willow, as well as investments in existing fields. We're forecasting an additional increment to investment in 2025 based on continued high levels of spending at the new developments. And continued drilling at existing fields. And then looking out over the long term, we're expecting a continued robust spending with capital expenditures stabilizing at a little under $3.5 billion per year. On the operating expenditure side of things, we're forecasting modest annual increases throughout the time horizon of the forecast based on a combination of cost inflation and new fields coming online and the costs of operating those new fields. One point to make on this slide is that we do have a risk adjustment that's made to lease expenditures, similar to how the production forecast is made. So for new developments, if there's a 80% probability assigned to production from a given field, we'll also use that same probability applied to the lease expenditure forecast. So if all of the fields come online as we hope, there's potential for additional investment in the state above and beyond what's shown here, as well as additional production.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, I appreciate that forecast got to look forward. It's got to settle somewhere. If we were to look at the trend line, especially on capital expenditures going back, does it tend to settle out and hit a stable level where it rests for a long time, or is that one of those things that swings pretty dramatically up and down?
Sure. Senator Keel, through the chair. So capital expenditures tend to be kind of two factors I would look at. One is oil price. Obviously, in a high price environment, we saw cost inflation as well as, you know, increased funds available for spending. In a very low price environment like we had in COVID, companies will cut back on spending. But on the other hand, just looking at the existence of major projects, so when you have a final investment decision on a major project like a Picker or Willow, you're going to see higher levels of capital expenditures for several years. I mean, these are fields where, you know, they're spending, you know, $1 billion a year on one field. So I think for the next several years, regardless of price, we're going to continue to see high levels of capital expenditure.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That variability, those big swings in our net profits tax environment, I think it's important that at this table we think about the impact those have on what we have to work with to serve Alaskans. It strongly suggests that we can't be thinking about the bare minimum CBR balance to avoid bouncing checks. Because when a great big capital expenditure drives our general fund down steeply, we still have work to do for Alaskans. So when we think about minimum CBR balances, it can't just be cash flow. We have to be able to ride out some of the peaks and valleys here. So I would encourage us not to think about $400 or $500 million.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we're going to, at least I'm going to need some help, probably other committee members also. When we look at the per barrel credit, we used to be able to calculate it pretty close for years. If you like the per barrel credit or not, we could calculate it pretty close. Now, with some companies at the minimum tax and some companies having no revenue and other mechanisms going on, we have difficulty fairly accurately guesstimating the per barrel credit taken against the revenue without going to the department and asking, because you guys have much more detailed information. And there seems to be, that delinking is somewhat of a concern. And I was wondering if you could help explain that, why that is, and then I'll have a couple more questions on the clarity that we try to get in our revenue projection and the fogginess of the current expansion on the North Slope that's going on the last couple of years and probably for the next several years, if not decade.
Who would like to respond to that question? Mr. Stickle or Commissioner?
I would be happy to respond to that question.
Please.
Co-Chair Stedman, so we have a complex oil and gas tax system. It's been referred to by consultants is one of the most complex in the world. And we do have a full presentation that we could spend an entire hearing going through the nuts and bolts, and we'd be happy to bring that before the committee at a future date. But in a nutshell, for the North Slope, our production tax consists of a net profits tax and a gross minimum tax floor. And there are per taxable barrel credits. There's two types of per taxable barrel credits. There's a sliding scale per taxable barrel credit for production that is not new production that ranges from $0 to $8 per taxable barrel. At forecasted oil prices, that would generate the $8 per taxable barrel credit. There's an additional credit for qualifying new production for the first 3 to 7 years that would be a $5 per taxable barrel credit. Companies, for the sliding scale credit that applies to the majority of production, companies can apply that only to reduce their tax down to the minimum tax floor, which is a 4% minimum tax floor. Around $70 per barrel oil prices, we're in a situation where some of the producers in the state are expected to be paying above the minimum tax floor, meaning they're able to realize the full $8 per taxable barrel credit for production, and some companies are going to be paying at or below the minimum tax floor, meaning that they cannot receive the full $8 per taxable barrel credit. And so when you're attempting to calculate the tax in the aggregate, you will get a very different number than when you're looking at company-specific calculations. And that's because we have some companies that are making very large investments in new developments and other companies that have a different portfolio of investments and operations.
Okay. And can I follow up? Then help us with the carry-forward credit and how kind of that works at a higher level, and we can hopefully have a future presentation in more detail. And then I'll have a follow-up question on that as the concern to us, the elected officials, being able to explain what's going on to the public.
Sure, Co-Chair Stedman. So we have basically, in terms of when a company is making investments in the state, there's three possible situations. So one situation is that the company is at or above the minimum tax floor, in which case the value of any incremental investment is able to offset their tax due to the 35% net profits tax rate. If a company is paying at the minimum tax floor, but still has a net profit, so they're between a zero profit and that minimum tax floor, any incremental investment does not have any benefit to the company whatsoever. If a company is in a net operating loss situation, so this would be where they are making such large investments that it takes their slope-wide profit into a number below zero, or for a new entrant that doesn't have sufficient production to offset those costs, then any investments that they make are beyond that zero gross value generate a carried forward annual loss. That carried forward annual loss can be used to offset future tax liabilities, potentially up to the 35% net profits tax in value. However, there's several provisions around that carried forward annual loss. After the 8th or 11th year, it begins to reduce in value by 10%, and that carried forward annual loss is also limited by the gross minimum tax floor.
Senator Stedman.
Okay, so when we look at the development that's coming, well, actually it's underway. It's not coming, it's underway. And it appears to be going to accelerate, not decelerate. There's going to be substantial amount of expenditures in the billions that Senator Keel had mentioned earlier, capital expenditures. A lot of those are going to be carried forward. And then oil production will go up and pipeline volumes will go up, hopefully marginal tariffs go down, everybody's happy, citizens will look at the Treasury and the revenue's not going to move much. And we're going to have to explain that. And that is part of this question, is to understand the mechanisms that are underway. Because one of the things we haven't talked about much here, when we look at the accounting cycle of a project, we begin with massive negative cash flow. You get first oil, you get lots of revenue, long taper out. But we don't stack them one after the other. So the expectations, it's highly likely that once the oil flow kicks in on like phase one or whatever you want to call it, they'll move to phase two and phase three, keeping those huge expenditures, making them an immediate write-off, which is what they should do. But we still, at this table, need to understand the cycle of multiple stages of investment, not just the one decision on one project and thinking that after the first couple of years, revenue is going to flow into the Treasury and we'll ride off the sunset with everybody smiling. We're going to have the legislators understand the mechanism so we can minimize misinformation and confusion. Some of us aren't expecting big revenue increases for several years.
Mr. Stickle, do you have comments?
Chair Stedman, you're correct that there's a time lag in revenue received from new projects. So another, we have a gross value reduction provision that offers a tax benefit on the production tax for the first 3 to 7 years. That's a significant benefit for new production. And then also, depending on where that production is located, the royalty impacts differ quite a bit. And I do have a slide coming up that I'll speak to that in more detail.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Commissioner Crum. Co-Chair Stebbins' point about where the cash flow positive aspects on a project occur to a state, we do have an example of that posted on the Department of Revenue's website with an in-depth analysis on the Willow project, which is this massive project that is having over $1 billion-plus annual capital expenditures as they get it up and running. First oil in a couple of years, but it won't be cash flow positive to the state until early 2030s. And that's part of the example of, I believe you're bringing up, is while oil will be flowing, the state's not going to actually see that money, but it's then going to be a very long tail. But it is important to note that it's cash flow positive to other areas, not only just the overall economy and the 15-to-1 multiplier effect before those jobs to the state, but also the property tax. That every time they lay down dirt for a road or a pad, that property tax then becomes a positive asset of infrastructure to that local municipality. So that's a good example for the general public. They'd like to see this of what it looks like on a specific project. And that's something we'll actually be updating. We do this on an annual basis, working with that operator to put together and decide which information they like to be shared out there for the public so they can see this. There's also a future thing as that project as a whole, based upon recent presidential action about expanding the go from 3 pads to 5. And so we're going to have to work with them to see what, in fact, that actually does to the overall timeline. But I just thought it would be a good example just to share. There is a specific project analysis on that with the timelines on when that cash flow comes in.
Thank you for those comments, Commissioner Crum. Senator Stedman.
Just a quick clarification for those watching at home, so we try to minimize the confusion. So what we're talking about here is the timing of cash flows and project economics. And as you accelerate the cash flows to the present, it enhances the economics, and if you retard them out in the future, the economics decline. And right now, that economics are attractive for expansion and development, and we see that. So I just want people to understand that that's what's going on when you change the levers of the cash flow, which is our the tax structure. It changes the economics of the project, and you could easily retard that economics or accelerate it with timing of cash flow. So just so people don't think we're, you know, take some rabbit trail, that I'm advocating a structural difference, or structural change, I should say. My concern is that the people at this table and in the building understand the economics of the working fields today, so we don't draw irrational conclusions and say all kinds of crazy things, which we have a tendency doing sometimes.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Mr. Stickle, please proceed.
All right, Dan Stickle for the record. Slide 23 shows a similar history and forecast for transportation costs. These are important to look at because they reduce the value of oil for both tax and royalty calculation purposes. And these transportation costs include all the costs of getting oil to the market, which is typically on the west coast of the United States, including feeder pipeline tariffs, the Trans-Alaska pipeline tariff, and tanker transportation costs, with the Trans-Alaska pipeline or TAPS tariff and marine tanker costs being the two largest components of transportation costs. So in fiscal year 2024, the average cost of transporting oil to market was $10.53 per barrel. We are expecting costs to be fairly stable over the 10-year forecast, actually reducing a little bit after fiscal year 2025 and remaining just under $10 per barrel. Looking at the two largest components, marine transportation costs have actually increased over the last several years as a combination of inflation and fuel prices. We are expecting those to stabilize, and then we're expecting the Trans-Alaska pipeline tariff on average to actually decrease over the 10-year forecast based on higher throughput into the pipeline. So one of the benefits of a new production from a field like Willow and Pica, even before there's a significant direct benefit, is that by having a larger number of barrels going through the pipeline, the cost of operating that pipeline on a per barrel basis actually decreases. So if we were not expecting an increase in throughput, this chart would look quite a bit different. And then finally, slide 24 is a chart that shows how the state benefits in terms of revenue from oil and gas production from different types of land. And the basic concept here, as we've been having some talk around the Willow Project, but the basic concept is that not all oil is the same. Historically, most production in the state was on state land with a fairly standard 12.5% royalty. This includes production from fields like Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk and several of the other so-called legacy fields. A lot of the new production is from other lands with different ownership rates. So state taxes, including production tax, corporate income tax, and property tax, these apply to all production within the state, regardless of who owns the land, and up to 3 miles offshore. Royalty rates vary depending on the ownership. So the state receives any royalty for production on state land and within state waters up to 3 miles offshore. For federal land in the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, or NPRA, and this includes fields like Greater Moose's Tooth Unit that is currently operating, as well as the Willow Development, the federal government receives the royalty for that land. They share half of that royalty back to the state, but those funds must be used to benefit the local communities impacted by the development. So essentially, the share of royalty from NPRA development is a pass-through share of revenue. For federal waters 3 to 6 miles offshore, ANWR Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR, or other federal land, the state receives a share of that revenue without any restrictions under current law. Currently, the only other federal revenue that falls into that next category is there's a small portion of production from North Star and in Cook Inlet that are in the federal waters from 3 to 6 miles offshore. For federal waters beyond 6 miles offshore, there would be no direct state revenue. However, were production to take place in that category beyond the 6 miles offshore, there potentially could be impacts to state economy as well as throughput into the pipeline that would have an indirect impact, positive impact to the state revenue. And then finally, for any private land, and this is mostly Alaska Native Corporation-owned land, the state doesn't get a direct royalty interest, but we do apply a tax on the private royalty interest, and that tax is 5% of the private royalty value for oil and 1 2/3% for gas.
Thank you for that. I think the comments that Senator Stedman made about the appetite in the building is quite relevant, and I would even say that that would apply to the Dunleavy administration, but what we haven't heard from the administration is potential new revenue sources. In the past, we've heard that that is a place that this administration is not going to venture into, and I'm wondering if that's the current position of the administration for this next 2 years, or has that been discussed? Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Commissioner Crum. At this point in time, I'm unaware of any new legislation put forward by the governor on new revenue sources.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from the department? Seeing none, Mr. Commissioner, thank you for the presentation, you and your team. It's always informative to have the presentation from the Department of Revenue. So that concludes the meeting today. Our next meeting is going to be Monday, January the 27th at 9 a.m. We will be hearing from the Office of Management and Budget on the governor's proposed FY26 budget. Any final comments from finance members? Seeing none, we are adjourned.